Mike, open up your Bibles to Joshua chapter 22. Joshua chapter 22 is where we'll be looking this evening as we go back to that book. We have looked at a number of lessons from this book, and as you're going through the book of Joshua, there is much to say about God's guidance and victory. And we looked at the destruction of Canaan most recently. We come towards the end of all of that. Canaan has been conquered, at least to the degree that it will be at this point. There's still enemies to fight, unfortunately, for Israel's neglect. But they've reached this point of being able to dole out the land. And each tribe is getting its reward. And if you remember at the beginning of all this, really before the beginning of all this, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh had decided that they thought the land on the east side of the Jordan looked just fine to them. And so they were content to stay put there. And that caused a little bit of a conflict. And Moses says, "What are you doing? You're going to stay here while your brethren go over here and fight and claim what the Lord has promised?" And they say, "Oh, no. No, we didn't mean that. We will absolutely go do our duty, our responsibility, and go fight with our brethren. Then we'll come back home and claim this land." Okay, Moses says. Good. I'm glad we got that cleared up. Well, those same tribes here in Joshua chapter 22 end up, I think, in somewhat of a similar situation with a misunderstanding, where they now are going back to claim, and then they do something here in Joshua 22 that causes some trouble. And so a delegation is sent over to address that trouble. And I'd like to just look at that situation, look at the people involved in that situation, and see how it was handled and see how it was resolved and see what lessons there are that we can learn from that. This altar of witness is the focus of the story here as we go through this chapter. Let's pick up there in verse 10 of Joshua chapter 22 as they're coming home. And it says there, when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the sons of Israel heard it, said, "Behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel." When the sons of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war. And the sons of Israel sent the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest. And with him 10 chiefs, one chief for each of the father's household from each of the tribes of Israel. Each one of them was the head of his father's household among the thousands of Israel. They came to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh to the land of Gilead. And they spoke with them, saying, "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away from following the Lord this day by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord this day? Is not the iniquity of Peor enough for us, from which we have not cleansed ourselves to this day? Although a plague came upon the congregation of the Lord, then you must turn away this day from following the Lord. If you rebel against the Lord today, he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel tomorrow. If, however, the land of your possession is unclean, then cross into the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, or rebel against us by building an altar for yourselves besides the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan, the son of Zerah, act unfaithfully in the things under the ban, and wrath fall on all the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity." Picking up in verse 21, the response is, "Then the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel. The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows, and may Israel itself know. If it was in rebellion, or if in an unfaithful act against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we have built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if our offer, or if to offer a burnt offering or grain offering on it, or if to offer sacrifices of peace offering on it, may the Lord Himself require it. But truly, we have done this out of concern for a reason, saying, in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and you, you sons of Reuben and sons of Gad, and you have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us build an altar not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it shall be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us that we are to perform the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, so that your sons will not say to our sons in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. Therefore, we said, it shall also come about that if they say this to us or our generations in time to come, then we shall say, see the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it is a witness between us and you. Far be it from us. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from following the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering or grain offering or sacrifice besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before His tabernacle. So when Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the congregation, even the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the sons of Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this unfaithful act against the Lord. Now you have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of the Lord. Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned from the sons of Reuben, and from the sons of Gad, and from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan to the sons of Israel, and brought back word to them. And the word pleased the sons of Israel. The word pleased them, and the sons of Israel blessed God, and they did not speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, were living. And the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad called the altar witness. For, they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. Now, you think about the shifting sands in that story. And you think about the characters involved and what they did and the parts that they played, and the sort of brink of disaster it looks like we're on at times. Here, they don't just sit a delegation and say, hey, I'm curious about that. They gear up for war. And they're sending a party across saying, we're going to work this out or we're bringing the swords. And so this is not just a matter of curiosity and let's have a big powwow. This is terms before war is declared. This is a very serious matter. And they bring up the seriousness by pointing back and say, listen, we've been through this and we're not going through this again. We remember very clearly what happened at Peor. We're not over it yet, what happened at Peor. And they go all the way back to Achan and they say, we're not over what happened with Achan. And don't you remember, it's not just Achan that suffered. And so it won't be just you who suffers. I want to look through all of this and I want to see some lessons that we can learn from the whole of this story. And I'm sure there's more lessons besides what we'll consider this evening, but just a few things to note. We'll spend a lot of time, incidentally, looking at Phinehas, and especially right here at the outset of the lesson, because the first thing I want to recognize is this character Phinehas is able to have balance in his life. That he's able to, on the one hand, be absolutely and unyieldingly passionate for the Lord and for His cause. And yet in this story, he is clearly able to be entreated and able to be reasoned with. It's not an either or. Go back to Numbers chapter 25 and we see what degree Phinehas' passion takes. He's one of my favorite characters here. He's one of my favorite characters because of this balance, because of these two stories that stand up, that are most particularly involving this one man, where you could almost say it seems like there's two different men, but it's two different men rising to do two different occasions, or one man rather rising to two different occasions. And one occasion calls for one response and the other calls for a different response. And he brings whatever response is necessary. In Numbers chapter 25 there and beginning in verse 6, here is that sin of Peor that they reference there. Here is the sin of laying with the women who have been brought in, the daughters of Moab, and they're committing fornication, and God has sent a plague upon them. And it says, behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses, in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Here's this plague ravaging Israel, and this man continues in the sins that have brought the plague. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation. He took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent, and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. What does God think of that? So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and those who died by the plague were 24,000. Well, you talk about a man zealous for God, a man zealous for righteousness, and a man zealous with passion that God takes note of and that God rewards. And you look at that violence, and we curl back at that violence and say, well, that seems a bit over the top. God certainly didn't think so. What Phinehas did right there was the appropriate response. It was what needed to be done to stop this disaster that was occurring. And so here's the man. So we have this problem over here with Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Hey, let's send Phinehas. You might think, oh no, don't send him. He's going spear first, killing people and asking questions later. But that's not who Phinehas is. Just because he took immediate and bold action here doesn't mean that he's someone who cannot be reasoned with. I understand that these two qualities can be separated. I understand that one can be to the exclusion of the other. I think there's a certain calculating reasoning, not Bible reasoning, not spiritual reasoning, but a certain reason among the Pharisees. Jesus speaks of that in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 23 when he talks about how the Pharisees are able to get down to the very details of the law, and yet they leave out the things that are more heartfelt. And the weightier matters of the law, he describes those things as. Woe to you, he says there in Matthew 23:23, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. On the other hand, we find Paul saying in Romans chapter 10, verse 2, that my brethren, that they are people who have zeal, but unfortunately it's not according to knowledge. And so there are people that, like Paul himself, as he was Saul of Tarsus, who have the zeal to go out and persecute the church because they don't know and they don't appreciate and they haven't learned what the church is and who Christ is. And so their zeal outstrips and outruns their knowledge. We want a man who is passionate, but we want that man to be reasonable. We want a man who is reasonable, and yet we want him to be passionate. These things do not have to be at odds in one person. In fact, as we look at Jesus, there are times where he absolutely shows his passion and zeal for the Lord. In Luke chapter 9 and in verse 54, though, Luke chapter 9 and verse 54, we find one of those occasions where here you have his followers and their zeal is let's have the zeal of Phinehas in Numbers 25. Let's rain down fire. It says there in Luke 9 and verse 54, when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? That is the Samaritans that would not receive him. And his response there is, no, he turns and rebukes him and says, you do not know what kind of spirit you are of. So here it is. Their passions are aroused. Their anger is aroused. And Jesus says, calm down. Let's think about this. Let's be reasonable. What's our purpose here? That's not our purpose. And so they continue on. But then you turn over to John chapter 2. And John chapter 2 is one of the occasions in which Jesus' passions are inflamed, you might say. Beginning there in verse 14, He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, "Take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." I think some of us maybe are disposed to lean towards one type of person or the other, and to maybe desire one type of person or the other, rather than looking for the man who has that balance, who is able to be passionate about the Lord, and yet who is also able to be reasonable. It's clear that we need a level-headedness. As you look at the qualities that go into being an elder in Titus chapter 1, beginning in verse 7, it talks about the man who is not swift to anger. It talks about a man who is reasonable or sensible, some of your translations will say. And yet by verse 11, we're talking about a man who's got to be willing to stand up and stop the mouths of certain people. So he can't just be the mild-mannered guy who stays away from confrontation. No, we start there. We have a man who doesn't want confrontation, but by the time it's over, he's a man who is of solid conviction and will stand up. We might say, with regards to preachers, that we want a mild-mannered, a mild-tempered sort of fellow. We do. We want a man who is not hot-headed and so forth. And I'll say this. If you have a man who never is worked up by anything, by any truth of God's Word, by any wickedness that he sees in the world. I was watching recently some footage, and it wasn't even footage about Planned Parenthood or that the specific footage of Planned Parenthood. It was about those things, the abortions. And it was the defense that people were making of the abortions. As I was watching that, I was physically angered. I mean, it is so disturbing at a base level. And I would say, with regards to those kinds of things, if you can watch that, if you can see that, if you can read about that, if you can look at God's Word and what God's Word has to say about life and see the disregard for that and kind of shrug your shoulders and say, "Oh, that's political," there's something wrong. You need to have some passion, and there needs to be some frustration, and there needs to be passion even in a positive direction. And yet for all that, sometimes we've got to calm down, and always we have to control that and never let it run away with us. And so I just see in Phinehas a pattern for a man who knows when to release that passion and let it run its course, and a man who knows when to control that and approach with that temperament that would keep this situation from turning into a disaster. We want both of those things in ourselves. We certainly want both of those things in our leaders. Well, going along those lines then, what we find here in Joshua 22 is that they were willing to listen to the other side. So here it is, they are geared up for war, they're ready to go to battle, and yet they ask for the explanation, and the explanation is given. And how quickly? I mean, you go from "we are ready to slaughter you all" to "oh, well, that is good." And all of a sudden it's just, "well, then let's go home." That's amazing to me. They truly did not want this. They wanted to listen. They wanted to hear a better explanation. And they are so pleased when they hear a better explanation. And I'll get to that in just a moment. But we need to be willing to listen. I want to say this, though, just kind of as a caveat here. There are times, again, drawing back to Numbers chapter 25, there are times when there is no possible explanation. You walk into the scene where your child's involved in something that they ought not to be, and this is not what it looks like. It's definitely what it looks like. And you don't leave room for explanation. You don't have a conversation. Look, no conversation. I saw this is over. And so you institute the punishment and you move forward. And there are times where that's just going to be the case. And I don't want to leave the impression that we always have to leave room for more discussion. I think we go overboard with that sometimes, certainly. Phinehas in Numbers 25 doesn't come in and say, "Now listen, I'm not sure exactly what's going on here. Could you explain this scenario to me?" No. There's no need to explain that situation. And so he takes action. Leviticus chapter 13, I wrote about this in an article a couple of weeks ago. Leviticus chapter 13, strange place to go to talk about sin. It's about skin disease. But you go there, and it's interesting. One of the things that you find there is that when the people come to the priest, there are some occasions there, verse 3, where they come to the priest looks and says, "Oh, unclean." And then the very next verse it says, "But if you look and there's this, this, and this, but you're not sure about this, then you say, all right, let's wait a week and let's see what happens." And so it's two very different scenarios. Some things are going to be very obvious and some things you're going to take a step back and go, let's see more about this before we draw any conclusions. And that's really throughout the chapter, those two different scenarios that you find. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 3, Paul's writing to the Corinthians and he's telling them what they ought to do about this man who has his father's wife. And he's already got the facts. And he says there, I've made a judgment. I've come to a conclusion without even being there. In other words, you can't possibly explain away the situation. There's no mitigating factors under which it would be okay for this man to have his father's wife. So why haven't you done something about this? And so, yes, there are going to be times where there's no need for further exploration. There's need for action. And yet, if there is any doubt, if there is room for doubt, then we need to exercise that patience. If there is some possibility of an explanation, then we need to leave room for that explanation. If you turn over to Proverbs chapter 18, Proverbs chapter 18, and there in verse 13, we see, "He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. But more to the point, go on down to verse 17, the first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him." And so if there's a scenario in which you go, "Now look, that sounds like a reasonable explanation, yet I see how there could also be another explanation," we need to wait. And we need to gather more. And we say, all right, maybe there's an explanation for this. Maybe there's something reasonable here that's going to turn this whole situation around. That happens in courtrooms all the time. A prosecutor will present some evidence and say, "Look, this man's fingerprints were at the scene of the crime." And the defendant says, "Yes, I work there." "Oh, okay, well, that sounded bad, but actually it wasn't so bad after all." And so sometimes there's a perfectly reasonable explanation, as there was here. So it may look bad, but we need to be willing to investigate if there is room for that. Not only, though, do we need to hear the other side, but we need to have some sympathy for that. And to want, I mean, as these did, and especially when we're talking about brethren, and that's what we're talking about here, countrymen, we need to want there to be a good explanation. I hope there's a good explanation here. And what we're trying to think from their perspective and have sympathy from their perspective. As you look at what Paul says with regards to the eating of meats offered to idols and so forth, and some of these conscientious matters he discusses in 1 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 23, he says, "All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify." There's this idea that it's not just, you know, you don't just consider what's happening right here in your circle, but you look and say, how does this affect that person? And you let their input have an effect on your behavior and on your perspective and your view. And you don't just say, well, you know, I'm going to make this decision based on what I see right here. No, that affects you and how you behave. And so in this communication with each other, there's got to be some sympathy. And that sympathy goes both ways. Notice, it is not just that Phinehas listens to what they have to say. I want you to think about what it would be like for somebody to come at you like Phinehas did. Somebody thinks maybe you've done something wrong. And so they come charging in, as it were, making accusations and saying, "What are you thinking?" You ever done that? You ever had that conversation with your children? You come charging in, "What are you thinking?" And they go, "Dad, I was just..." And then they have an explanation. And you're, oh, good. That's not what I thought it was going to be. So here's Phinehas, and he comes in. Why are you leaving the Lord? Why have you transgressed? Why would you do this evil in His sight? He brings all these examples, and these people don't go, "How dare you come over here and tell us that?" Well, they're very gracious in receiving that, and they say, "No, we get it. If that's what we were doing, we would totally understand, and you need to destroy us. May God bring it upon us." They're ready for that. And they're sympathetic to why these people are so upset. They get it. And we need to be. If we do something and we see that, I see why you might have gotten a wrong impression here. And if that was the case, absolutely, I appreciate that you would be so on top of this. But we're so offended and we don't want anybody to have any criticism or any concerns about what we're doing. We want people to stay out of what really does concern them, but we think doesn't. And so we act offended. But both sides listen here. It is the accused who listens, and then it is the accuser who listens. I think of Paul in Acts chapter 9 as he goes to try to join himself to the church at Jerusalem. I think of the strength in Saul of Tarsus, this new convert. So much room for discouragement as he comes and to join himself to other Christians. And they go, "Not a chance." They are afraid of him. "You can't be a part of this group." And then Barnabas comes along and he explains the situation. And then they listen and they allow Saul of Tarsus to become a part of that group. And he goes in and out and he becomes and begins to work with that group. I think so many today would just say, "I don't care if they do accept me. I am done with them." But it shows me that Paul is willing to understand that these are the very people that he was persecuting, and he understands why they would be afraid. And he does not run away from that, but he continues to pursue that relationship, even though they are apprehensive at first. And we need to be willing to see things from other people's perspective, understand why people are doing things, and be willing to give some leeway to concerns on both sides of an issue like this, for instance. Well, finally, there is the peace of God that they arrive at, and the work towards the peace of God that they arrive at. We should have no pleasure at the thought of conflict. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 3, Paul writing the second letter as he's on his way to Corinth, he's coming. He's already gotten on to them for some things in 1 Corinthians, and he says that, you know, I'm hearing good reports about that. You've received it well. And he talks about the sorrow that he's caused. And he says, "Look, I want this to be worked out, because when I get there, I'd like it to be a happy visit. I want there to be peace between us when I arrive." Paul doesn't want to come in and have to knock heads, as it were, when he gets to Corinth. And I think there are some people, man, they just roll their sleeves up. They can't wait to get into it with somebody. And they look for opportunities. I knew a fella, he told me a guy was visiting in the area and called him up and said, "I wonder if you would be interested in having a debate." And my friend said, "Well, what are you interested in debating about?" He said, "I don't know. I'm sure we can find something we disagree about." I'm just not interested in that, he told me. I'm not looking to argue just to argue. I'm not looking for conflict. We're not scared of it. We're not afraid of conflict, but we want to avoid it. And the reaction of these people, it's clear. It's clear that Phinehas, and it's clear that the children of Israel want to avoid conflict. We should not revel in disagreement. Those people in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 4 who have a morbid interest and questions that just bring up strife. One lady, one time, we talk about not making for peace. My grandmother was good friends with another woman who, the other woman believed that it was wrong for a woman to wear pants for any occasion. And my grandmother disagreed with that. And so this third woman was on an outing with them, and she would bring that up. I said, now Verna, you believe it's okay to wear pants, don't you? And Sister So-and-so, you don't believe that, do you? And then she'd just sit back and watch and enjoy herself. And she just flat out said, I like to watch people argue. Well, I'll tell you what, Paul talks about you, doesn't he? And if we have a morbid curiosity, a morbid interest in watching people disagree, there are people, I think, who are actually disappointed when we come to terms on something and we can't get into an argument. Well, that's unfortunate. I wish we could have worked that out. A man actually said to me one time after being with him for several days in a gospel meeting, he kept bringing things up, looking for areas of disagreement. And I say that because he said, I'm going to find something we disagree on. He did. And then to his disappointment, I wasn't willing to argue about it because it had to do with signs and revelation. And I said, you know, look, I'm really not that dogmatic about that. But he pushed and he pushed and he pushed and he wanted so badly to get into a disagreement. Just willing to go there. I'm willing to disagree. I'm willing to hold the truth up in the face of confrontation. I don't want it. We should, in fact, go out of our way to make for peace. You look back there again in Joshua 22. When they are coming in and they are, you know, they are ready to go to war. And yet, what do they say? They say, look, if it's a problem with the land over here, you come right on over here and you find a spot in our land. Whatever it takes, we want to avoid this. And so it's not that they're just saying, hey, look, y'all better take care of that or we're coming to war. It's, how can we fix this? What do we need to do? Including giving you some of our territory, some of our property that's already been allotted to us. It's fine, whatever. We do not want to bring this upon the whole nation. In Acts chapter 21, Paul has come to the conclusion of his third journey there in Jerusalem. And as he arrives in Jerusalem, he comes and he tells about the wonderful things that have been done among the Gentiles. And the response there is, you know, basically good. We're glad that these things have been done. And they glorified God. But it says there in verse 21 that they, the Jews, have been told about you and that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, and all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat, sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from fornication. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification, until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. I'll tell you what Paul had a right to say. I don't have to do this. You have no right to demand this of me. I'll tell you what Paul wants. He wants the souls of men to be saved. And he wants accord with his brethren. And if they say, do this, that Paul has absolutely no responsibility to do, Paul will put that responsibility on himself. What do we need to do to get past this? What can I do to move this forward? Now, the unfortunate thing that we will note as you continue on in that context is peace is not a one-sided affair. So here Paul does that. He does this to avoid conflict with the Jews, and they use it as the very thing to stir up conflict. And they say, hey, he had a Gentile with him, because they saw him walking around town with a Gentile. And they say, clearly that Gentile must have been in the temple with him. Therefore, Paul took a Gentile in the temple. How dare he? And so we find in verse 30, the crowd comes together. They seize him. They take hold of him. And this will eventually lead to Paul's imprisonment all the way to Rome. Well, I'll tell you what. I guarantee you, there's no way you can lay this at Paul's feet. He did everything that could be done in his power, even taking on responsibilities that were not his own, in order to try to avoid this. And so we do. But we always pursue peace with God first. And so our pursuit of peace, as Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, is as much as depends upon us. We live at peace with men. And yet, there are things that we are going to do, we're going to be required to do in order to serve God, that are going to cause division between us and men. I look at Exodus chapter 32. Very similar situation to Numbers chapter 25. There in Exodus chapter 32, you might remember, is the occasion of the golden calf. Moses hears of this from Joshua and the Lord, and he descends from the mountain and he finds the people dancing around and acting without control there in verse 25. And his response there in verse 26, it says, he stood at the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword on his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother, every man his friend, and every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed. And about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. I don't know what you think about those Levites. I think they're incredible. I don't think they're men who disregarded their brothers and their neighbors and their friends. I don't think they're people who didn't love those people, who didn't want peace with those people. I think there are people who loved God unequivocally, unquestioningly. And when Moses said, I need people who are for God, they said, what do you need us to do? Kill your friends. Done. That's a boldness that we lack so very often. We're not called to pick up a sword. We're not called to go to physical war for God. But I tell you what, Jesus does say in Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, if you do not hate your father and your mother, your sister and your brother, you cannot come after me. I love everyone here. I particularly love three girls that generally sit up here right on the second pew. And I hope and I pray I'd walk away from every one of you to go to the Lord. Turn my back on all of you. And I hope you'd say the same to me. That if the Lord said, who is for the Lord, you'd say me, if everybody else in here stood silent. That's Phinehas. This reasonable man. This man who's willing to listen. He's a man who's also willing to take up a spear and be for the Lord. I don't want to encourage you to let your passion outrun your reason. I don't want you to get so worked up that you fail to direct your passion with knowledge. But I'm afraid the world is cultivating in us the reasonable sort of Christian who doesn't get too worked up about this religious stuff. He's not overly serious about it. There was a video recently, I'm a Christian, but, that began making the rounds in the internet. I'm a Christian, but I'm also a homosexual. I'm a Christian, but I don't judge others. I'm a Christian, but, and the list goes on and on and on. And I'm going to tell you the conclusion of it. You might as well have said, I say I'm a Christian, but I really don't believe any of this stuff. Because that's the conclusion of all of that. If you say I'm a Christian, then it's going to mean that you believe a lot of things that are hard to stand for. And we want to be reasonable, and we want to hear people out, and we want to have peace, and most especially with our brethren. And yet, when it comes time to stand and stand against, then we have as much passion as anyone, as much passion as Finna has. If you're here this evening and you're not a Christian, God would appeal to you, and He would appeal to you on the basis of reason. Come, let us reason together, He says, through Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 1. And He would appeal to your passion. And then He says, I gave my only begotten Son to you. And so He would try to convince you, and then He would try to bring you to tears and say, come unto me. And if you can see the reason that He offers, and if you can be impassioned to stand for God, then we urge you to make that stand this evening. If we can help you in any way, won't you come forward while we stand and while we sing?